Sindri followed Kane out of the operations center and back to the infirmary. From a storage closet on the far side of the laboratory, Kane pulled down a folded plastic body bag and a number of thickly napped towels. These he shoved into Sindri's arms. The two men returned to the anteroom. Sindri, his mobile mouth twisting in disgust, helped Kane wrestle Bry's corpse into the body bag. The scrawny man weighed not much more than a suit of clothes, and Sindri knew Kane could have done the insertion by himself. After Bry was snugged within the zippered cocoon, Kane and Sindri began swabbing up the blood and wiping down the wall, cleaning it of viscera. After a few minutes of hand and knees mopping, Sindri paused.
"Throttle me again if you want, Mr. Kane, but in my opinion, we're wasting precious time. And I'm not making a pun."
"Not in my opinion. And in this place, my opinion is the only one that matters."
Sindri's body stiffened with barely repressed anger.
"Have the last 3 decades of hardship and deprivation addled your memory? You ought to remember that I can be pushed only so far."
Kane's face, what Sindri could see of it through the black silver-stippled beard and long forward-falling hair, was a mask of bemusement. He continued to work.
"Donald Bry was an obsessive-compulsive pain in the ass. But when all was said and done, he remained a friend to me when most did not. We'll be going after Tanvira, but I won't leave the man to lie like this, as if he's no more important than a squirrel run down by a wag. We're going to clean up in here and give him a proper burial. Then we'll be about our business."
"All right, but how can we be about our business? Colorado is a long way from here."
"Just wait and see."
After the mop-up was completed to Kane's satisfaction, he and Sindri carried Bry's bagged body out of the operations center and the redoubt altogether. The air was still surprisingly mild, even at hard-on midnight. Sindri appeared a little startled by the warm breeze, then disconcerted when he glanced up at the vast, star-speckled canopy of the sky overhead. As Sindri had been born in an enclosed artificial environment, and after spending most of his life in specially built habitats on Mars and then Parallax Red, Kane figured the little man had a touch of agoraphobia, a fear of open spaces. However, he didn't complain as he gripped the body bag by its strap, lugging his burden at an oblique angle across the plateau. At the edge, where the tarmac disappeared into grass and shrubs, they struggled up a slope to a row of grave markers. At the far end, a pair of graves gaped open. They were partially obscured by tangles of scrub brush, with high mounds of dirt between them. The headstone of the one on the end read, "Donald Bry." The inscription on the one beside it was even more succinct. It bore only a single word, "Kane."
"I can see you were prepared for this eventuality. Or was this the work of Bry?"
"I dug them both. I figured if I went first, the best Bry could manage was to haul me up here and dump me. Since he preceded me..."
Kane shrugged and slid Bry's body into the waiting hole. Sindri watched him do it in silence, alert for any sign of tears. There was none. From beneath a clump of bushes, Kane pulled out a canvas-wrapped bundle. He tossed aside the flaps and removed a pair of T-handled spades. He tossed the shorter one to Sindri.
"Let's cover him up."
They dug into the mounds of earth, breaking through the dried outer crust.
"Was Bry born a cripple?"
"No. Over 20 years ago, he and Bridget tried to rescue me from an enemy stronghold in India by trading tech for my freedom. Bry came along with her, more or less as a Trojan horse, a geek who was supposed to explain and demonstrate the instruments."
"Apparently, his masquerade wasn't successful."
"It was to a point. During the negotiations for my release, he planted incendiaries all around the place, but..."
Kane's words trailed off, and he began spading up and dumping the dirt with a sudden fierce vigor.
"But what? What happened to him and to Miss Bridget?"
"Bridget was killed. So was Grant's wife, Shizuka. We cremated their bodies there. Grant kept Shizuka's ashes. I scattered Bridget's here. We all thought Bry was dead, too, consumed by the fires. He was seriously hurt, but he was alive. He crawled off into the jungle, where he was found and nursed by locals. A year later, I came to the place as a sort of memorial, and that's how I found him again.
I'm sorry about Miss Bridget.
Kane glanced at the small man across the open grave and realized he was trying to extend sympathy, the little of which he was capable. Kane was once more reminded that even the darkest of hearts harbored a glimmer of light. As it was, Kane never had been able to dredge up much genuine hatred for Sindri. Bridget had once referred to him as a warped little man with ambitions enough to challenge God. He was certainly that, but he had also proved he operated on his own skewed code of honor. Also, and Kane had never admitted it to anyone, he had always felt a grudging admiration for the little madman, and he was never sure why. He was just as crazy as some of the enemies Kane had killed, and even more fixated on carving out a personal empire as others. But the one characteristic that separated Sindri from that kind was his ability to entertain. The man possessed a childlike enthusiasm for wreaking havoc, and Kane had always related to that, as ashamed as he was of it now. By working in tandem, the two men filled the grave within a few minutes. After tamping down and smoothing the dirt, they stood on either side of it, leaning on the spade handles and panting. Sindri gestured toward the headstone bearing Kane's name.
Who is there to bury you now, Mr. Kane?
I charge you with that responsibility, if the situation arises.
Sindri nodded graciously.
I accept that responsibility if you grant me one codicil, that I have your permission to piss on your grave after I've laid you to rest.
Permission granted.
Kane placed the spades back within the canvas square, rewrapped it, and shoved the bundle back underneath the bushes. Then he started climbing up to the ridgeline.
Follow me.
With a mystified expression on his face, Sindri did so. At the top of the slope, Kane walked a more or less straight route for a score of yards, then down the face of the incline. He marched through closely growing trees, following a faint path that Sindri wouldn't have noticed as such if he hadn't been following Kane. After they had walked some 100 yards from the burial ground, Kane came to a halt. At first glance, they stood in a small, bowl-shaped clearing, with a tall tangle of bushes, shrubs, and foliage making up the inner curve. Sindri's eyes picked out shorn saplings and tree stumps protruding only a few inches above the ground.
Why are we here? Kane gestured.
To go about our business.
Sindri followed the taller man's gesture and saw only the snarl of overgrowth. Kane stepped to it, thrust his arms into the tangled vines and leaves, and pulled. He lifted away a large section of a carefully camouflaged shelter made of cross-braced tree limbs interlaced with grasses, weeds, and shrubs. The forepart came away in 3 large pieces. Inside, he saw the outline of a tall, streamlined shape, which at first glance was unrecognizable in the darkness. Kane tugged away camouflage netting, and Sindri saw a metal-sheathed object that reminded him of the general shape and configuration of a flattened javelin head, not much more than a wedge with wings. He stepped closer.
What the hell is it, Mr. Kane?
Kane pulled away more of the screen of shrubbery.
It's a trans-atmospheric vehicle. We found several of them on the moon base nearly 30 years ago and flew them down. This is the only one remaining. We called them Mantis ships.
Sindri's eyes passed over the ship's contours, seeing that the resemblance to seagoing manta rays was more than superficial, particularly with its pair of extended, curving wings. He judged the wingspan at around 20 meters and the fuselage at 15. A short tail assembly was tipped by an ace of spade-shaped rudder. The hull's composition appeared to be a burnished bronze alloy. Covering almost the entire surface were intricate geometric designs, deeply inscribed into the metal itself. They were interlocking swirling glyphs, the cup and spiral symbols, even the elaborate cuneiform markings. The hull was smooth, with barely perceptible seams where the metal plates joined. The craft had no external apparatus at all, no ailerons, no fins, no airfoils. The cockpit was almost invisible, little more than an elongated, symmetrical oval hump in the exact center of the sleek topside fuselage.
This TAV doesn't look like Terran manufacture or design. Not like the suborbital X-planes the Air Force was designing before the nuke cost, or the Aurora stealth plane. Those markings looked like Sumerian.
Kane didn't look up from his inspection of the landing gear.
That's because they are Cimmerian. We never knew for sure, but these craft were more than likely created by the Anunnaki.
The Anunnaki? Do you know how old that would make that crate, then?
Only approximately. The metallurgical analysis Bry performed on the hull suggested it's a minimum of 10,000 years old. It could be twice as old. But don't worry. Being stored on the moon for all those millennia kept it in perfect working order.
How in God's name did you get to the moon?
It's not really important. I'll tell you about it when we have more time.
Pun intended? Cain came out from beneath the manta and clambered up a wing to the fuselage.
Actually, no.
Sindri gave the machine a long, distrustful stare.
What powers that thing?
Cain found the canopy latch and popped it open.
Two different kinds of engines. A ramjet and solid fuel pulse detonation air spikes.
Sindri nodded in understanding.
So, working together, they enable it to fly in a vacuum and in an atmosphere?
Exactly.
The maximum cruise speed should be around Mach 20.
More like Mach 25 on a good day.
Cain extended a hand downward.
Come aboard.
Sindri started forward, then hesitated.
There's enough room?
I installed a secondary jump seat a few years back. Anyone else would be cramped, but you should have plenty of leg room.
Sindri flushed in irritation, but he took Kane's hand and allowed himself to be hoisted up onto the hull and the cockpit. As Sindri strapped himself in, Cain slid into the pilot's chair. He directed Sindri to put on a radio headset. A bronze-colored helmet with a full-face visor was attached to the headrest of the pilot's chair. A pair of tubes stretched from the rear to an oxygen tank at the back of the seat. The helmet and chair were of one piece, a self-contained unit. The instrument panel was almost dismaying in its simplicity. The controls consisted primarily of a joystick, altimeter, and fuel gauges. All the labeling was in English. When Cain slipped the helmet on over his head, he heard the whine of an internal power source juicing up immediately. The interior curve of the helmet's visor swarmed with a squall of glowing pixels. When they cleared a nanosecond later, he had CGI icons of sensor scopes, rangefinders, and various indicators. At the same time, the helmet automatically extended a lining and seal around the base of his neck. As he strapped himself into the chair, he heard a hiss of static.
Can you read me, Sindri?
Loud and clear.
I'm powering us up.
Don't I get a helmet or an oxygen mask or something?
You won't be needing an oxygen mask. My goal is speed and stealth, not altitude.
What about a helmet?
You won't need one of those either. At the speed we'll be traveling, if we crash, the impact will kill you instantly. A helmet might prolong your agony by a second or two.
Safety first, as always.
Cain was glad the visor concealed the grin that had crossed his face at Sindri's discomfort. He closed and latched the canopy, then pulled the joystick lever back slightly. He rotated it and pushed it forward. It caught and clicked into position. The cockpit resonated with a high-pitched whine as Cain engaged the vectored thrust ramjets. The manta began to rise straight up with a steady grace, and Cain withdrew the tripodal landing gear. Fine clouds of dust puffed up all around. Cain nudged the control and increased the speed of the lift. Cain's helmet HUD displays offered different vantage points of the ascent, and his eyes flicked from one to another. He watched as the burying ground and the plateau quickly receded. The mountain peaks that contained the Cerberus Redoubt shrank into gray cones. The manta made a wide, slow, circling turn that gave Cain time to double-check all engine and flight instruments. The precision-tuned machine operated flawlessly. Sindri remained silent in the jump seat behind him during the maneuvers, either too enthralled by the experience or too terrified to speak. Grinning within his helmet, Cain engaged the pulse detonation wave engines, and the manta hurtled across the sky like an artillery shell exploding from the barrel of a cannon. The trailing sonic boom slammed its thunderclap behind the manta, and Cain felt the concussion running through the hull of the ship. Sindri yelped in astonishment as he was slammed back against his seat. Cain couldn't help but laugh. The manta followed an NOE course, nap of the earth, skimming above and flattening the treetops beneath the fury of its passage. Cain flew with unerring precision from Montana and into Colorado by cutting across southern Wyoming. Cain didn't want to fly too high, nor did he want to fly too slowly. He compromised with a general altitude of 150 feet and 300 miles per hour. He kept to the wilderness areas, skirting mesas and mountains, forests and waterfalls, basins and plateaus. The LARC subsystem, the low-altitude ride control, fed him turbulence data. The controls automatically dampened the effects of turbulent air pockets by the deflection of two small fins extending down from beneath the cockpit area. When the Manta entered Colorado's canyonlands, Kane increased the altitude. The TAV wended its way around the Grand Mesa and skimmed the Book Plateau until it reached the Gunnison National Monument, a rugged wilderness of gorges and cloud-scraping pinnacles of rock. Once past it, they would be in the official outland territories of High River. But Kane didn't relax. He was not surprised when his ears started buzzing. He recognized the sound as the radar lock-on warning, piped from the forward sensor array into his helmet. Glancing out of the starboard side, he glimpsed a brief flash of distant silver. It was high and moving as fast as the Manta. It grew larger until he caught the reflective glint of moonlight on the silver, backswept wings. Seeming to float in the air between his eyes and the visor, a column of numbers appeared, glowing red against the pale bronze. When he focused on a distant object, the visor magnified it and provided a readout as to distance and dimension. Now he focused on the aircraft soaring in from the direction of High River. Kane had expected an airborne welcoming committee. The aircraft looked like one of the supersonic dragonflies that had seen brief action toward the end of the Consolidation War. As he recalled, they were good for high-altitude recon work or bombing runs, but not so suited for low infighting or fast, tight maneuvering. However, the dragonflies were equipped with a murderous array of firepower, including a complement of short-range attack mini-rockets and a 30mm Vulcan cannon. For inflicting destruction at a safe remove, the aircraft had slung beneath its canard outrigger fins six homing cruise missiles for use against moving ground targets, like armored divisions or supply convoys. The Manta was at 1,000 feet. He shoved the joystick forward and pushed the TAV toward the rocky ground. The Dragonfly followed, for a moment flying at a wing-to-wing level, although separated by several hundred yards. Still, it was close enough for Kane's helmet sensors to allow him to see the red triple-elongated triangles insignia on the Delta wings. Then the craft rose above and ahead of him, sweeping into a screaming high-speed curve. If he had been trained properly, the pilot would try to maneuver behind him. Kane reduced his altitude even further until the Manta skimmed barely 100 feet above the stone-littered plateau floor. He watched the Dragonfly complete its turn and disappear briefly from his line of sight behind a cliff. Kane yanked back on the stick and fed the ramjet thrusters full power. The acceleration slammed him against his chair. The Manta whipped over on its port side wing in a steep bank just above the rushing earth. A second later, a stream of tracers blazed through the darkness like phosphorescent threads and exploded against the ground. Sindri had been oblivious to the situation until the moment of acceleration.
What the hell is going on? Who is shooting at us?
Kane hooked a thumb to starboard.
See for yourself.
The Dragonfly flashed by the Manta, and Kane caught a blurred glimpse of a helmeted head with a grimacing face below a dark visor. Kane leveled off the TAV. On his new course, he headed toward the gaping jaws of the Black Canyon. Beyond it rose the peaks of a low mountain range, the Sangre de Cristo. He thought it might be. The mountains were 4 or 5 miles away, just about perfect for his next tactic. Keeping the Manta low, he maintained watch on the CGI signature representing the angry dragonfly. He could easily imagine the kind thoughts and profanity going through the pilot's head. No doubt he had been scrambled out of a warm bed to fly a recon with orders to destroy the Manta on sight. Kane was sure the orders made no allowance for failure. The pilot seemed relatively skilled, at least in high altitude and substratospheric flights. But the ground had to have seemed frighteningly close, and maneuvering at such high speeds would make him nervous. Kane decided to stress him out even more. Sideslipping the Manta to port, he guided the machine into the Black Canyon.
Oh my God!
Flying through the Black Canyon was like trying to thread a needle with a runaway locomotive. The sheer rock walls grew closer and more threatening with every maneuver. Treacherous downdrafts buffeted the Manta perilously close to the foaming rapids of the Gunnison River, which rushed through the ramparts of stone. Kane's hands were constantly busy with the pitch, tab, and trim controls. He gazed at the computer-generated image of the landscape on the HUD. Data scrolled down the side of the display, reviewing and assessing primary areas of danger beyond his line of vision. Each boulder, outcropping, and curve in the canyon showed in detail. At the beginning of the flight some 30 minutes before, Sindri had yipped and crowed with delight at the precision flying. Kane remembered the little man's jubilation 30 years before when he put the Aurora through its paces. Now he was having a difficult time keeping the yips of delight from turning into bleats of terror as the walls of the gorge whipped by in a blur. Suddenly a fireball bloomed portside, barely 2 yards above the Manta's wing. The aircraft shuddered from the rolling concussion. Kane felt the shock from the fuselage traveling through his body.
What the fuck was that?
A rocket with a low-impact warhead. He's trying to shake us up.
Kane swerved the Manta around an outthrusting shelf of rock. As he completed the maneuver, the ship lurched sideways as a piece of the canyon wall exploded in a flaming, flaring shower of rock chips. The fragments rattled noisily against the fuselage.
Damn it! Why don't we defend ourselves?
Because we aren't armed.
Sindri's response, if he had one, was lost in the shrill keening of wind as Kane pushed the Manta into a steep dive down toward the foaming surface of the river. The ship skimmed over the top, sucking up plumes of water in its wake. A column of water erupted off to their right as another mini-rocket detonated in the riverbed. The Manta was splashed and jarred by the shockwaves, but Kane kept it steady. The canyon's winding and twisting course became worse instead of better. It was a helter-skelter jumble of outcroppings, detritus, and scatterings of house-sized boulders. The only good aspect was that the terrain was far too confusing and obstructive for the Dragonfly to try launching another attack. The pilot gained as much altitude as possible and hung back. After 5 or so minutes of the nerve-jangling flight, the canyon walls receded and the gorge widened out into a valley. Instantly, Kane heeled the Manta over, working it into a flat spin. It was a dangerous maneuver so close to the ground, but he had calculated the risks. The range was still too long for the Dragonfly's mini-rockets, but Kane figured the pilot would remedy that very quickly. The HUD showed the Dragonfly banking and diving in pursuit, shortening the distance between them very swiftly, just as Kane had predicted, because the pilot had been trained in the techniques of high-altitude, maximum-power approaches, but was too nervous to cut in his throttle so close to the ground. He was a skilled air jockey, nevertheless. He performed a smooth barrel roll to shorten a pass that would have carried him miles away and made a roaring return for another strafing pass. But the fast decreasing altitude made him back off after launching only one rocket. It went wide, doing nothing more than coating the Manta's hull with dust. Still, the pilot had his orders and apparently a set of stainless steel testicles. Even as the Manta skimmed swiftly above the ground, casting a shadow ahead and below it almost identical to its seagoing namesake, the Dragonfly prepared for a final effort. It rose up on an arc, then soared down at a 45-degree angle, its cannon thudding, a tongue of flame dancing from the barrel. Kane saw the fountains and divots of dirt and rock explode as the rounds hammered a cross-stitch pattern into the terrain. A mini-rocket exploded on the right, a brilliant red-yellow spout of fire. The control stick fought his hands as the sudden concussion made the TAV shudder. Clods of turf and shrapnel rattled briefly against the hull's undercarriage. He banked the craft a few degrees to starboard, but maintained the altitude. The mountains came toward them rapidly. Both aircraft were well below the summits. Kane saw no vegetation to speak of on the higher slopes, just a litter of stone. Under the cold moonlight, the range looked menacing, and the deep, dark valleys between them, filled with forest, weren't much more inviting. He pushed the control stick forward, and the Manta surged ahead, its speed increasing to 500 miles per hour. The Dragonfly buzzed in pursuit, its own velocity building. Kane kept a careful watch on the HUD readings, which clocked the enemy ship's rising speed levels. He knew that in order to catch them now, the pilot would have to kick in the afterburners. Kane slowed the Manta at the precise instant the Dragonfly's afterburner spit blue flame. It soared overhead like a projectile loosed from a slingshot, heading directly toward the mountains. The peaks were very close, and Kane held the TAV's nose toward the nearest one.
What the hell are you doing?
Kane didn't answer, watching as the Dragonfly's pilot struggled to reduce his craft's speed as it closed in on the mountain range. The sheer, deeply fissured rocky peak swelled in his visor, and according to the measurements scrolling madly within the helmet, a collision was unavoidable. The conical mass loomed up over them like a thundercloud. Sindri began kicking the back of his seat.
Fear off! We'll crash! Fear off!
Kane ignored it. A red square of light suddenly appeared on Kane's HUD, superimposed over a small grid-enclosed digital simulation of the mountain and the Dragonfly. Simultaneously, the warning chime sounded. Then the icon representing the Dragonfly seemed to be sucked into the CGI mountaintop. Instantly, Kane pulled back on the control column and the TAV swept into a steep climb, the pulse detonation jets roaring. The Manta skimmed across the crest of the peak with only a few feet between it and the TAV's undercarriage. A shaved sliver of a second later, he was blinded by a hell-hued blossom of light as the Dragonfly fuel tank ruptured, ignited, and exploded. Kane swung the Manta around and headed back away from the mountains. As he recrossed the peak, he saw a great ball of flame marking the crash point of the Dragonfly. It had collided with the mountain less than 50 feet below the summit. The wind of the TAV's passage tore through holes in the pall of smoke so he could see the burning, blackened hull of the Dragonfly. The plexiglass canopy was too flame-scorched to discern movement behind it. Sparks corkscrewed into the air. The impact and explosion started a small landslide, and pieces of wreckage tumbled down along the mountainside.
Mr. Kane, I can't believe you managed to accomplish the miracle you just did.
Neither can I. I thought my miracle-making days were behind me. But before you put too much faith in me, we still have to make it to High River in one piece.
The Manta soared over the irrigated greenness of cultivated fields and over the silvery windings of the Kanab River, a tributary of the Colorado. Kane looked down at the clean, well-lit city spread below. High River was built on the bluffs overlooking the waterway, on the foundation of Cobaltville, which in turn had been built on the foundation of Vistaville, once the domain of Baron Alfred Nelson. He was now a very long time moldering in an unmarked grave, but even after the city became Cobaltville, the streets still seemed haunted by the memories of his bloody deeds. The walls rose 50 feet high, and at each intersecting corner, a watchtower protruded. At one time, the towers had housed Vulcan Phalanx gun emplacements, but those had been removed years before. The walls themselves had been rebuilt in the years since the Consolidation War. The old stone was sheathed in a blue-gray alloy. In its flat expanse were faint, swirling patterns, but no seams or cracks. The construction technology that had refurbished the walls and changed Cobaltville to High River was far beyond what had been in use even before the nuke cost. There were no longer any checkpoints on the road leading up to the city's gate, no dragon's teeth obstacles, no armed patrols. But as in the old baronial days, powerful spotlights still washed the immediate area outside the walls, leaving nothing hidden from their glare. One of the official reasons for fortifying the baronies was a century-old fear, or paranoid delusion, of a foreign invasion from other nuke-scarred nations. It had never happened, and Kane had always wondered how the barons figured any country could mount a large enough army to establish anything other than a remote beachhead. Inside the walls still stretched the complex of spired enclaves. Each of the four towers was joined to the others by pedestrian bridges. Few of the windows in the tower showed any light, so there was little to indicate that the interconnecting network of stone columns, enclosed walkways, shops, and promenades was where thousands of people made their homes. The dark and noisome streets of the Tartarus pits no longer crisscrossed at the base of the enclaves. The Ville Baronial Society had been strictly class and caste-based, and the design of the Villes themselves reflected the cultural demarcation. The higher a citizen's standing in society, the higher he or she might live in the enclaves. The lowest level of the Ville castes were the servant classes, who lived in abject squalor. The population of this class was ruthlessly controlled. Those lower levels were known in the Ville vernacular as the Tartarus Pits, named after the abyss below hell where Zeus confined the Titans. But the seething melting pots of cheap labor and crime had long ago been rehabilitated and merged with the rest of the community. However, the enclaves still formed a latticework of intersected circles, all connected to the center of the circle, from which arose the tower known in baronial days as the administrative monolith. The massive, round column of white stone jutted 300 feet into the sky, standing proud and haughty, but now a symbol of consolidation. All other monoliths in all the other former baronies had been either demolished during the war or torn down afterward. The only reason this particular one still existed was out of deference to the wishes of the Imperial Mother, Erica Van Sloan. Kane piloted the Manta in a wide, low-altitude circuit around the city.
Looks peaceful enough.
Wait.
As if Kane's one-word response were a cue, circular hatches opened up all over the walls, dilating like the lenses of cameras. From the hatches rose disc-shaped lifts, depositing uniformed troopers at various points on the parapets. They swarmed out and took up positions in well-ordered drills. At a quick count, Kane estimated there were perhaps 20 of them. Their boots, coveralls, and helmets were midnight blue with facings of bright scarlet. They brandished streamlined rifles with barrels like truncated cones. Power cables trailed from the stocks to bulky power units attached to their belts. All the troopers were slender of build and so blank of expression they might have been mistaken for mannequins in military dress. The faces under the polycarbonate helmets were of human shape and features, but all of them were identical as to complexion and expression, paper pale with a strange waxy sheen. Their eyes beneath the overhang of their headgear barely blinked, and their small mouths did not so much as twitch.
What the hell are they?
Soldiers of the CCS, Generation 2.5, I guess. Frightening spectacle, aren't they?
Are they droids or something?
Something. A hybrid of hybrids is the best way to describe them. They're synthetic, not necessarily artificial. All their parts are organic, except for the squid implants, which more or less program them like droids.
Tower-mounted searchlights track the TAV, white funnels of incandescence sweeping up and across the ramparts of the city walls. Two of them struck the Manta and stayed there. Despite the tinted canopy and Kane's visored helmet, the light was blinding. But the light activated the electrochemical polymer of the canopy, and it immediately polarized, cutting off at least half of the light's candle power. As the Manta made another pass, the troopers lifted their rifles and triggered them almost in unison. Neither Kane nor Sindri saw or heard anything but brief flashes of light. However, both men felt the Manta shudder beneath multiple impacts before Kane whisked the craft up and out of range.
What kind of weapons are those? Lasers? Tasers? Phasers?
None of the above. They're called ASPs. Accelerated streams of protons. Something Sam developed.
Very inventive. The weapons accelerate protons to great speeds and discharge them as bolts of plasma. They must pack more kinetic and thermal power than a laser.
Exactly.
Then perhaps you'll be good enough to explain exactly how an unarmed aircraft will be able to land without being protoned to pieces.
One thing I learned about the Mantas, they don't always need weapons to be deadly. With the right pilot at the controls, they become weapons.
Kane twisted the control stick and the TAV surged upward, almost standing the ship on its tail. He made an almost vertical bank and the Manta plunged directly toward the surface of the wall. The cockpit resonated with the high-pitched whine of stressed engines and the slipstream of air sliding around them. The soldiers raced back and forth, putting the ASP rifles to their shoulders again. Light flared from the barrels and the TAV's fuselage shook from jarring blows. Static discharges crackled inside the cockpit, crawling and leaping from one piece of electronics to another. Sindri howled in pain and clawed the radio headset away from his face. Kane ignored him, waggling the Manta's wings, tilting the craft up from side to side. He steepened the angle of the dive to gather momentum. The searchlight still tracked across the empty sky, swinging to and fro. At the very last instant, Kane pulled back on the control stick and the Manta leveled off, roaring above the raised lip of parapet by scant inches. Troopers dropped flat as the undercarriage skimmed over their helmeted heads. But a few of the masked soldiers weren't so fast or so lucky. The wings of the TAV scythed into them, breaking them in the middle or crushing their skulls. They were swatted off the walls like red and blue bugs. The facade of the White Tower swelled in the TAV's viewport, and Kane kicked the Manta into a tight orbit around it, as if the huge structure were a maypole. He retraced his course back to the wall. The few remaining troopers fired their rifles at the ship, halos of white energy dancing around the barrel. Engaging the vectored thrust ramjets, Kane dropped the Manta straight down and gracefully brought it to rest on the extended tripodal landing gear right in the center of the parapet.
Now what? These soldiers have guns and we have shit!
You didn't listen to me very closely, did you?
Kane touched the controls and changed the angle of the ramjet vents. 5-yard-long tongues of blue flame licked out from the apertures and touched the soldiers who were approaching the ship from the rear and to the sides. Instantly, their uniforms burst into flame, and they became capering scarecrows made of fire. Kane touched the controls again, and concussive bursts of superheated gas battered the burning men, driving them back with drunken, reeling steps. They vanished over the edge of the wall, either hurling themselves to safety or to their deaths. Kane cut the power to the engines and removed his helmet.
You're a cold-blooded bastard, Mr. Kane.
That's quite the compliment coming from you. Or was it a compliment?
Sindri shrugged.
I'm not sure.
Kane unsealed the canopy and slid it back. He and Sindri climbed out and down. The odor of scorched flesh and heated metal hung heavy in the air, and Sindri wrinkled his nose at it.
Now what?
Kane gestured to the nearest corner tower.
We can get to the street level through there.
And do what? Get shot at some more? Arrested? Killed? You don't even have a gun. When I knew you before, you were always loaded down with enough firepower to take out half of the Cydonia colony.
Kane waved a negligent hand through the air and started toward the corner tower.
We got this far without guns, didn't we? Besides, I lost my faith in musketry a long time ago.
And when was that?
Around the time Bridget was killed.
Where are we going? To see the Imperator?
No, he sees nobody. Not no way, not no how. Besides, he doesn't hang out here.
Whoever hangs out here has tried to kill us twice.
Very true. But now that we're here, I'm betting that Lakesh won't want us dead until he's had the chance to talk to us.
What are you basing that bet on?
I think Tanvira reported only to her mother about me bringing you out of zero time. Erica was the one who gave the orders to have us intercepted and shot down. Not to mention killed if we tried to land.
Kane saluted the air in the direction of the tower and the small spy eye atop its spire.
But by now, Lakesh has seen the vid of the two of us, and he'll give us safe passage. At least so we can be questioned. He'll be sending an escort.
Sindri shook his head in exasperation.
It would be nice if you had informed me of your wagers, plans, and hopes before we embarked.
That would spoil the spontaneity.
The men had walked a little over half the distance to the tower when a lift disc hatch irised open directly in their path. It didn't disgorge more troopers. Instead, a spide rested on the platform. Sindri stiffened, mouth dropping open in astonishment.
What the hell is that thing?
The escort I mentioned. It's called a spide.
A spide?
A spide. It's an unmanned drone based on the old hover tank designs.
The spide's bulbous metal body was about the size of a small wag. A dome-shaped turret head dominated the top of it, with six glassy eyes that looked very much like convex crystal lenses. On each side of the body protruded four jointed rods, ending in bifurcated steel claws. Alternating between the legs were long, flexible tentacles. The entire body was mounted on a circular base about 10 feet in diameter. The spide didn't produce a clatter of treads or rumble of wheels or even the growl of an engine. All they heard was a faint throb. Kane heard Sindri panting in terror, and he didn't blame the little man one bit.
They ride on a cushion of air provided by huge turbine fans, so we can't really outrun it.
Another invention of this Sammy the Imperator?
Actually, no. They were put in use by the Barons as siege engines. Several of the original versions were kept in the anthill. You might recall seeing a couple of them in the same place the Aurora was stored.
Sindri's brow wrinkled as he tried to match the machines in his memory with the device that stood before him now.
It doesn't look like the same things I remember.
Sam improved on them.
Even though Kane knew the Spide was only a remote-controlled automaton, not a demon, the machine still wasn't exactly a sight to soothe the nerves. He eyed the mechanoid, noting the design differences between this model and the ones used during the Consolidation War. Sindri shifted his feet as if he intended to return to the Manta.
Don't run.
Instead of a reply, he heard Sindri suck in his breath with a hiss. There was a faint whirring sound, and the spide extended its tentacles. They snaked along the surface of the wall toward them. Sindri watched the metal serpent slink closer and closer.
Shit!
Sindri's courage deserted him, and he did the exact opposite of Kane's warning. He turned and ran, dashing back toward the Manta. Before he had crossed more than 5 feet, an eardrum-compressing hoot blasted from the spide. Its glassy eyes flashed. A gust of compressed air heaved it several feet from the surface of the lift platform, and with a whine of turbofans, it glided after him. The four legs provided extra support while both of its tentacles shot out after the little man. Kane threw himself to one side, barely avoiding being struck by one of the tentacles as it lashed out and whipped around Sindri's knees. He was jerked off his feet and lifted into the air. The spide dangled him upside down. He yelled in fright, arms flailing as he pried at the flexible metal conduit entrapping his legs. Kane leaped after the machine, jumping onto its back, his feet skidding and seeking purchase on the slippery alloyed surface. He crawled toward its head, hoping to deactivate the sensor array in the turret. He barely made it halfway. With a whir, the head swiveled to face him, and Kane experienced a shuddery instant of staring into the crystal eyes and sensing outrage. Then the other tentacle coiled up and slid over him like a noose, cinching tight around his waist. Kane struggled as he felt it raise him above the surface of the spide. He tried to fit his fingers between the tentacle and his body, but the world dissolved around him in a blaze of blue flame and a torrent of pain. Kane dreamed in fragments, but none of the fragments made any sense. A humid cloak of darkness swathed most of his mind in sweaty ebony folds. Only infrequently came brief flares of light and cogent thought. The wavering lights took on the appearance of faces, faces that somehow resembled his mother, his father, and other people he knew, but couldn't name all at the same time. He had an inchoate awareness that he had promised to do something for that face, but he couldn't remember what. He knew he was dreaming, just as he knew it was pointless to try to remember what kind of promises he had made to dream faces. He doubted he would remember the dream or the faces in the light of day. There were far too many dreams to recall over a lifetime of them. Distantly, he wondered just how many dreams he might have experienced over a span of decades. Daydreams didn't count, for they allowed the dreamer to possess at least a modicum of control, and most of his daydreams had been pleasant. No one except the incurably psychotic would daydream a nightmare when more pleasing fantasies of power and sex and simple happiness were but a thought away. So Kane realized he was in the throes of a nightmare, simply because he wasn't enjoying himself. Time seemed to hang motionless, even while his mind raced onward like a runaway war wag with the pedal bolted down hard to the metal. He was aware of nothing but a void surrounding him. Then, with the kind of abruptness that happens only in dreams, the void ended against a huge iron-braced door. It loomed up before him, but he didn't slow his mad flight. Right before he thought to crash headlong into it, the door opened directly into a long, broad hall that grew indistinct in the murky distance. Kane raced along the corridor, not allowing himself a moment to clear the confusion from his thoughts. The corridor walls were lined by flickering torches and metal sconces. The floor, walls, and ceiling were of stone, cut into huge square blocks. The walls on either side of him were covered with brightly colored friezes, portraying men and women he thought he recognized. The images flickered and changed whenever Kane tried to focus his eyes on them. As he plummeted past, it almost seemed that the women in the friezes bore Tanvira's face or hair or eyes. The women smiled as their bodies were fondled by various male partners, some of them with handsome, finely chiseled features, and others who looked more like animals. Sweet William stepped out from the frieze, oozing slime from every knobby wart, ridiculously clad in the open red jacket of one of Lord Strongbow's dragoons, and nothing more. The Pishchakas greeted him with outstretched talons and foam-flecked fangs. Kane flashed through him as if the goblin man were no more substantial than a shadow. Voices spoke. It took Kane a long time to visualize the people who belonged to the voices. At first, he tried to outrun the voices, to leave them behind in the void, but they followed him.
You're breaking old, ingrained habits and acting out of character. That'd be deadly.
You brought all this up. Curiosity always has its price, you know.
If you keep on pretending you're a professional fridge model, she'll find somebody who doesn't think he is.
Grant, Bridget, Domi. The names echoed in the hollow halls of his memory. There were other voices, other names he knew he should remember, faces he knew he had seen somewhere. He tried to call out into the dreamscape surrounding his racing body, but he could force out no sound. The only noise he could hear was inside his chest, the oxygen within his lungs echoing heavily with the dull thump of a multitude of air sacs expanding open and slamming shut. With each new opening and closing sound, he felt his lungs constrict. Kane kept flying, feeling his heart clenching and unclenching painfully inside his chest. He dashed through a series of empty chambers lit by a ghostly illumination. The long corridor abruptly ended in utter impenetrable blackness, like a sepia sea. Kane couldn't stop himself, and he plunged into it. All around, the darkness was filled with stars. His vision blurred, and he wondered to himself which would kill him first, his heart bursting or soaring into the heart of a star. He managed to twist his neck and look around and down. There was no horizon, no land, no earth, only stars, and he realized he was surrounded by an inky black curtain dusted with a million grains of diamond-dusted starlight. The stars were everywhere at once as he plunged through them. All around him, suns burned with a pure, clean radiance. The clouds of nebula glowed silver against the primal black. Constellations wheeled and glittered. He could feel the movement of the universe pulsing against him, hear the songs sung by the stars. Somehow, he realized he was floating through a point in non-space and time from which all spaces and times were accessible. He also knew a single consciousness was responsible for that accessibility, and it was unnatural. Almost as soon as the notion registered in his mind, he saw a pair of crimson stars smoldering among the millions of constellations. They glittered before him, glowing like malignant eyes. They drew Cain forward as if his consciousness were made of metal filings and the eyes were magnets. He tried to stop, to slow down, to change direction. Instead, he plummeted toward the hell eyes, all control gone. The crimson radiance grew brighter, more vivid, and around the crimson stars formed a face. It was a man's face, undeniably human, yet with alien, hellishly glowing red eyes. The high-boned face was very pale, with sharp cheekbones and a jutting chin. His ears were very small and delicately shaped, nestled close to the hairless skull. His inhumanly large, curved eyes had no pupils, only obsidian irises with a bare hint of white at the corners. The eyes were less organs of vision than apertures leading to the fathomless ends of the universe. Then the flesh seemed to melt away, revealing a gleaming metallic mask of burnished silver, made even more ghastly by the red eyes burning in sunken sockets. Delicate inlays of circuitry coated his fleshless skull. Small white teeth grinned in a mirthless leer. The grinning, naked skull floated in the sepia sea, a gleaming silver in which sparks of livid red flame danced within the shadowed sockets. A sudden riot of images exploded in his mind. They were only wheeling pieces, splinters of fire and blood in the gulfs of deep space. He felt a crazed tumble of emotions, all different but all simultaneous. Anger, stark terror, and a grief so deep it seemed his heart would shrivel. He felt a sickening sensation as all stability and sanity crumbled. Then he careened through scenes of carnage, of blood and fire. Monstrous pillars of flame roared above the skyline of cities. Men, women, and children fled, howling like souls in hell. He saw rows of red things strapped to tables, living human beings in the process of dissection. He glimpsed white bones and blood and strips of flesh laid back for the inspection and removal of internal organs. He stared at a world, at many worlds, in torment, at skies across which curtains of black smoke scudded, as blistering shockwaves wrenched mountains from their beds, flattening cities, monuments, and all the works of humankind. A voice seemed to whisper to him, not from far away, but from everywhere. It was a voice he had heard before.
I penetrate all the barriers between casements, going back into the past, infiltrating the highest corridors of power, so that when the proper historical moment arrives to strike, the world changes forever.
Cain struggled not to scream in horrified realization as recollections of the warning from so many years before flooded into his mind.
You will know my presence in your own casement soon enough. By then, I hope you will have resigned yourself to what cannot be changed. Do not fight anymore. There is no use in it.
Cain was no stranger to fear. He had lived with it daily, and it was an emotion he long ago had learned to bottle, to contain. Now it escaped and spread through him like a virus, consuming him with terror, horror, and panic. He set his teeth on the scream rising from his throat. The death's head leered at him, and the jaws of the skull opened. A peal of hideous laughter poured from the yawning jaws. Cain plunged toward that gaping maw, determined not to give voice to his surge of terror. Cain felt an insistent, jiggling pressure. He tried to roll with it, but he couldn't seem to move. Finally, he realized a hard object was prodding his right shoulder. He didn't open his eyes, but tried to decode his surroundings and circumstances with his other senses. Warmth surrounded him, and the lethargy it evoked kept him from responding to the pressure. His nostrils filled with a rich floral odor.
Cain!
His eyelids lifted. The lighting was muted, diffused, and the world looked strange. Shadowy figures moved, wavered back and forth.
Cain.
The woman who leaned over him seemed grotesque at first, impossibly deformed as if stretched by some monstrous torture device. Then Cain realized the impression was one created by his poor vision and artifice. The woman's pants, hugging her long, lithe legs, were cut high at the waist and fell over stilt-heeled boots that gave the illusion of great height. Her waist was tightly cinched by a red sash, and the narrow shoulders of her black tunic were lifted by tapered pads. The fabric was tailored to conform to the thrust of her full breasts. Emblazoned on the left breast was a familiar symbol. A thick-walled pyramid was worked in red thread, enclosing and partially bisected by three elongated but reversed triangles. Small discs topped each one, lending them a resemblance to round-hilted daggers. Cain squinted up at her, trying to pierce the fog that seemed to float over his eyes and see her face. At the same time, he realized he lay in an uncomfortable bed, covered from the neck down by a thick quilt. He was surprised not only by the bed, but also by the fact he was alive so he could wake up, the bed's discomfort notwithstanding. His thought processes moved ponderously, like half-frozen mud, but he realized the spide had rendered him unconscious with a jolt of voltage rather than frying him like a slab of bacon. He didn't feel particularly grateful for the machine's restraint. The back of his head ached fiercely, and his skin prickled painfully, as if he were suffering a body-wide sunburn. He started to sit up, but pain hit the back of his head like a club, and the bed spun. A wave of nausea churned in his belly, and he lay down again, closing his eyes tightly.
"Don't move too quickly. You're still recuperating."
Kane nodded as if he understood, even though he didn't.
"Is it really you, Erica?"
"You know it is, Kane. It's been many, many years. When Tanvira told me that you would be coming after her, I didn't know what to feel. I apologize for the reception. I didn't authorize the airborne attack or the soldiers' assault."
"But the spide was your idea?"
"Yes."
The flat, almost dead intonation of her voice caused the hairs on his nape to tingle. She sounded old and weak and helpless.
"How long have I been out?"
"Around 14 hours.
He opened his eyes a slit, and his sense of perspective slowly returned in a piecemeal fashion. He slowly looked around, gauging his surroundings, feeling a distant sense of familiarity with them, despite the fact the room was small, with cheap furnishings, a narrow bed not much better than a cot, a cabinet and small table on which was placed a framed photograph. He squinted at it, trying to identify the three people it featured. Then he realized it was a pic of himself standing between his father and mother. He hadn't seen the photograph in many, many years, or the people in it. He looked at the image of the cocky, eager kid he used to be. He was smiling in the picture. His father and mother weren't. His dad had the same dark hair and high-planed features as he did, but he looked brooding and unhappy. His mother's somber expression spoke of the same emotion. Kane's mother had vanished from his life right after he entered the Magistrate Division Training Academy. Her disappearance wasn't unusual. Though matrimony and child-producing were considered the supreme social responsibility by the barons, it was also considered only a temporary arrangement. Children were a necessity for the continuation of society, but only those passing stringent tests were allowed to bear them. Genetics and social standing were the most important criteria. Generally, a man and a woman were bound together for a term of time stipulated in a contract. Once the child entered a training regimen of one of the Vil divisions, the parents were required to separate, particularly in the case of male children recruited by the magistrates. So his mother had removed herself. She had probably realized there was a limit to the pointlessness she could endure of being a parent in absentia. Kane had never really known, but he had often wondered if the entire purpose of her life had been to give birth to him. After he entered the division, her duties discharged, the rest of her life had to have been one long, total anticlimax. As for his father, the last sight of him was impressed indelibly and eternally in Kane's mind. He knew even if some horrible accident wiped his memory clean of everything else in his life, he would never forget his visit to Nightmare Alley in the Archuleta Mesa installation. As the Center for Advanced and Ongoing Genetic Experiments, Nightmare Alley was well named. It was horrible, unbelievable, insane. There, he, Bridget, and Grant had found Kane's father, suspended in cryonic stasis, his body now supplying its superior genetic material for later hybridization. His father's fate remained unknown, even after the incendiaries they had touched off during their first incursion had wreaked wide devastation. The odds that his father had survived were exceptionally remote, but Kane was by nature a percentage player, and even a 1% chance provided a feeble ray of hope. However, the devastation caused by the crash of the Aurora a year later was certainly more widespread, and even if his father's cryostasis canister had come through the incendiary explosions intact, the last wave of destruction more than likely engulfed it, as it had the rest of the installation.
"I'm in Cobaltville, aren't I? In my old flat."
Erica pushed a flexible straw between his lips, and he gratefully drew in a mouthful of cool water.
You're in High River in the Enclaves, yes. They were restored many years ago as a way to honor you if you ever decided to join us. Like a memorial for the services you rendered to the cause of unity before, during, and after the war.
Kane nearly choked on the water as the absurdity of her statement sank in. All four-room apartments in the residential enclaves were essentially interchangeable. Conformity, standardization, whatever the euphemism, the flats were about as home-like as a cell block. None of the doors on any enclave level had locks. It was a carryover from the program of unification when the Council of Front Royal had decided that privacy bred conspiracy. The Council had further decreed that since everyone had the same possessions as everyone else, there was no need to steal, especially among the elite. The desire for privacy was viewed not just as gauche, but as an expression of deviant thinking. He recalled his few paltry personal possessions from those days. He had owned absolutely nothing anyone would want. Most of his property had been inherited from his grandfather and father, including the photograph. Since the apartment was more or less the Kane ancestral home, it should have been filled with relics of earlier generations. It wasn't. There were a couple of lamps, a chair, a table, a sofa, the futon in the bedroom, a few antique books wrapped in plastic, a couple of ancient muzzle loaders confiscated from Ferrer traders nearly 60 years ago.
This must be the ugliest and most boring museum display in the entire history of the world.
Erica didn't laugh. She sat on the edge of the bed and held the cup of water with one hand while stroking his forehead with the other.
The pain will soon pass. Once you heal, you won't even have a scar.
Still swallowing water, Kane squinted up at her, finally able to see her face clearly. The mirrored lenses of the sunglasses covering her eyes gave her the expressionless stare of an insect. Her black hair hung loose around her shoulders, pushed back behind her ears. It looked lusterless, almost like a cheap wig.
Scar?
From the surgery. You now have a squid in your brain, just like everybody else. Welcome to the CCS. Welcome to the Adaptive Earth.
Heart pounding frantically within his chest, seeming to hammer against his ribcage as if trying to escape, Kane levered himself upright. His temples throbbed with the effort. His fingers explored the occipital region of his cranium, and they touched a scabrous lump at the vertex point. A sharp needle of pain stabbed through his skull from back to front and made his eyes water.
Oh, why?
I'd like to say it so you won't be so hard to get along with. But in reality, it was done so you'll understand how being linked with Sam, with the heart of the world, is not quite the form of cyber slavery you think it is. You'll adapt in time.
Was this done to Sindri?
Not yet. As the authorities of High River, Lakesh and I are still trying to decide how much of a contribution he might make, how adaptive he would be. Besides, he's been telling us the most interesting stories about what you've been up to with my spatio-temporal dissociator.
Struggling with his fury, trying to restrain himself from striking her, Kane saw his distorted reflection in her glasses. His face looked different somehow, but he couldn't instantly identify the changes. Then, with a surge of shock, he realized all the gray was gone from his beard and hair, and the fine lines around his eyes had been replaced by firmer flesh. Snarling, he raked the glasses from her face. She didn't move or even react except to smile at him sadly. He had half expected to see red eyes bright with the fires of hell, but did not. The fury rising in him was choked off, replaced by a sick horror when he looked into her blind eyes. The violet glints were covered by a milky sheen. They were old eyes, eyes that had seen too much and given up trying to make sense of the visions. He noted the deeply etched creases of weariness at the corners, the half-moons of puffy flesh beneath them, the seams and lines she had tried to bury beneath coatings of cosmetics.
Not much to look at nowadays, am I?
Still angry, Kane put a hand around the graceful column of her throat, seeing the wattle sagging beneath her chin.
Sam has let you grow old, but he makes me younger.
Sam sees himself as a teacher. He teaches lessons in humility and obedience.
Did you need such a lesson?
I'm no longer strong enough to know. It's been a hard life, Kane. Damn hard.
She caressed his wrist with a long-fingered, delicate hand. It, at least, bore no signs of aging.
Sam has already begun the lessons with you.
How did he do this to me? He didn't touch me like he did you and Lakesh all those years ago. Is the implant the secret?
She nodded, and Kane removed his hand from her throat.
Nanotechnology is. It took me years to learn the true source of my son's powers. They are not organic. They're not psionic.
I never really thought they were.
He placed his feet on the floor and stood, swaying, unnerved by how rubber-kneed and lightheaded he felt.
Can you get me some clothes?
Look there.
He snorted, then removed a pearl-gray, high-collared bodysuit. He recognized it as the old day-duty uniform of the magistrates. It smelled slightly musty, but it was the only article of clothing inside. He knew asking about his shadow suit would garner only evasive answers, particularly if he asked questions about the data cards and the CD. Kane pulled on the bodysuit.
I remember how DeFore found nanites in Lakesh's blood a long time ago. They had attacked his cellular structure, as I recall.
The simplest medical applications of nanomachines didn't involve repair, but selective destruction. Cancers were only one example. Infectious diseases provide another. The nanites were programmed to recognize and destroy the dangerous replicators, whether they were bacteria, cancer cells, or viruses.
Kane tugged up the collar, feeling his strength and equilibrium return.
So Sam's nanites performed selective destruction on the genes of DNA cells, removing the part that spells aging?
Something like that. Or in my case right now, removing the part that spells youth.
Where in the hell did the nanites come from in the first place? Did Sam make them or find them?
She shrugged, groping on the bed for her sunglasses.
I really don't know. I never found out, even after all these years. But Sam has to have access to a huge database somewhere. Repairing damaged or cross-linked molecules is one thing. Identifying them is another.
Kane reached around her and picked up the glasses from the quilt and handed them to her.
What would be the most efficient way of doing that?
Erica slipped the sunglasses back on.
Faced with a damaged protein, a cell repair machine will first have to identify it by examining short amino acid sequences, then look up its correct structure in a database. The machine will then compare the protein to this blueprint, one amino acid at a time.
As Kane pulled on the ankle-length boots, Erica provided him with a swift overview of the function of the nanomachines and how they had restored her and Lakesh's youth and maintained it for so long. She told him how repair nanites stimulated the heart to grow fresh muscle by resetting cellular control mechanisms. The list continued through problem after problem, physical ailment after physical ailment, until Kane grew impatient.
I get the picture, Erica. What about the damn squid in my brain?
Oh, that's a little different. A lot more complicated. I could tell you what I designed them to do over 200 years ago, but Sam has twisted their operating principles into a totally different direction.
I figured.
Kane put his hands on his hips, finding it strangely comfortable to be wearing the gray uniform of a mag again. He watched Erica slowly rise from the bed, saw the stir and lift of her breasts beneath the glossy fabric of her tunic. Her figure appeared to be the same as he remembered it, despite the changes in her face and demeanor. He tried, but failed, to reconcile the tired, saddened woman standing before him with the fragmented memories of the wild and imperious Scorpia Prime.
Take me to Lakesh and Sindri.
That's why I'm here.
Erica started toward the door, moving uncertainly at first, reaching out for the frame. Kane took her by the elbow to guide her.
Thank you, but I don't really need your help.
But your eyes...
still work.
Erica tapped the lenses of her sunglasses.
With the help from the nanites in my system, the microprocessors in the frames hook up with them and generate a weak electromagnetic field that stimulates my optic nerves. The glasses give me photomultiplier vision, gathering all available light. Another setting gives me infrared.
Nice. Better than your own eyes.
More efficient. Not necessarily better.
They left his flat and entered the main promenade. The wide, curving passageway was thronged with movement, with people heading to and from their duty stations in the administrative monolith. But then, as he and Erica moved along, he noticed the heads of men and women turning toward him, eyes widening with recognition, and he heard his name whispered. "If nothing else, I've got fame," he reflected sourly. "I'm a legend." Kane told himself his legendary status sprang less from his exploits than from being the only man to refuse an authority's position in the CCS, in the Imperator's adaptive Earth. But he knew that wasn't true. A number of the people who stared at him and the Imperial Mother were small and compact, with delicately featured faces that seemed to be primarily brow, cheekbone, and chin. Their craniums were large, but not inhumanly so. Their heads bore wisps of thin, fine hair. The eyes beneath delicately arched supraorbital ridges were big and slanted, but white could be detected around the irises. Their steps were graceful, almost mincing, their hands long and slender. Several of the men wore magistrate black and had plastic tube-shaped holsters strapped to their thighs. Kane experienced an instant of shuddery dread when he saw the holsters. One part of his mind knew the infrasound batons, which converted electrical current to sound waves by a maser, weren't very precise weapons and were very limited in range as well. But he had been on the receiving end of the wands too often to dismiss them as unthreatening. As he and Erica reached the elevator bank, a tiny hybrid female, pretty and crisp in a white bodysuit, despite her large cranium and oversized eyes, gave him a startled look of appraisal, then of recognition. He could only assume that the hybrid woman had been one of the many ordered to participate in the breeding experiment over a quarter of a century before. Since the hybrids aged very slowly, she could very well look the same now as she had all those years ago. She was probably disturbed by how old Kane appeared, despite the lack of gray in his hair. The female's huge blue eyes were startlingly clear and calm. Kane felt his heart clench in his chest due to her resemblance to Quavel. The doors to the lift slid shut on the staring eyes.